This is Sustainable East End, a monthly series about how land use, water resources, energy, transportation, and food impact the environment of the Twin Forks of Long Island. With co-producer Tony Ernst, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This month, I moderated a panel discussion on the film 2040, The Resurgence, about Project Drawdown, something we've reported on in the past on this show. The film is focused on solutions to the climate crisis that will draw down the amount of carbon in our atmosphere to safe levels for our climate. The panelists included Reverend Kimberly Quinn Johnson of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the South Fork, Rob Calvert, a member of the steering team of Project Drawdown East End, Tina Mill, co-chair of Drawdown 100 Women for Women, and Miles Stokowski from Sag Harbor, a student at Middlebury College in Vermont. Also, we heard from Scott Carlin of the Ecological Culture Initiative in Hampton Bays. Here's our discussion.
I want to start out with a general question. We are assuming that our audience has watched the film 2040, or if they have not watched it, they will. It's focused on solutions to the climate crisis that will draw down, hence the name draw down, the amount of carbon in our atmosphere to safe levels for our climate. And one key concept running throughout the film is donut economics. This model has as a center hole of the donut, showing the proportion of people that lack access to life's essentials, like equity, healthcare, education, etc. The crust around the edge of the donut represents the ecological ceilings or planet boundaries that life depends on and that we cannot overshoot. So the donut model shows how the climate crisis and its solutions are bound up inextricably with issues of racial and other forms of social justice. In fact, social justice isn't a sideshow to the emergency. Social injustice is a fundamental cause of the climate crisis. And this is something that the film 2040, what was said by Paul Hawken of Drawdown in a Q&A after the film. And I think it was a very, very important point. So I'd like to start off our discussion with each panelist commenting on this connection between the climate crisis and social justice. And Reverend Kimberly Johnson, I wonder if you can start off with your comments about this connection.
Awesome, thank you, Francesca. So I'm actually gonna talk about three things that are related to this issue of climate justice and social, economic, and racial justice. But the first thing that I'm actually going to talk about is the relationship between climate justice and faith. I think for us to do the things that we need to do to adjust our relationship to this planet will require a radical shift for some people. For other people, maybe not a radical shift, but an intentional consideration of our place on this planet and our responsibilities to it. So lots of people, regardless of your faith, have grown up in a culture that suggests that humans are given dominion over the earth, that it's ours to rule. And you can be a benevolent ruler or a careless ruler or a cruel one, but the planet is yours to do with as you will. My faith tells me something different. My faith tells me that I am part of an interconnected web of existence, of humans and trees and oceans and mountains and cows and spiders and mice. And so that means that I am to approach my relationship with the non-human parts of this planet with the same care and respect, the same humility, and the same love that I have for human beings. I don't rule the earth. I recognize that I am part of, and a small part, of a really vast and complex system that is an expression of the holy. And so if you are a person that believes in God, the way that I would say that is that you are a small part of a vast and complex system that is God itself. And how I behave toward the planet is how I behave towards God. And I think if we imagine it that way, it really shifts how we treat this earth and what we imagine is our responsibility and our relationship to the earth. The second thing that I want to talk about is race and racism. We know that Black and Indigenous and people of color, I hope that we all know this by now, are disproportionately affected by climate change, that we disproportionately bear the brunt in our physically in our bodies, economically, in our neighborhoods, in almost any way imaginable, bear the brunt of our destruction of this planet. In this country, Black and Hispanic people are exposed to more pollution than we produce, while white Americans enjoy better air quality than average, despite creating more pollution than average. We know that power plants, refineries, trash dumps are most likely to be found in Black neighborhoods. In Louisiana this week, two environmental activists were arrested as terrorists, protesting a plastic manufacturing plant in what is called Cancer Alley. Cancer Alley is the stretch along the Mississippi River from New Orleans to Baton Rouge that is littered with industrial plants, predominantly African American. Almost every single family in this area called Cancer Alley, every single household, not just family, household, has someone who has died from cancer. A couple summers ago, I probably would have done it again this summer, I did some work with the Bayou Bridge Pipeline, so the Bayou Bridge Encampment, protesting a pipeline along this Cancer Alley that was to be part of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So the water protectors, led by Indigenous activists and Indigenous cultural workers, have drawn our attention to the real cost of fossil fuels and extractions on Indigenous land, Indigenous people, Indigenous culture, and their own resistance to that Dakota Access Pipeline and then other pipelines and projects. And then globally, climate change causes the most harm in poorer countries occupied by people of color around the world, while Western, wealthy, predominantly white countries contribute more to climate change through our fossil fuels use, through our agriculture. So it's the same dynamic that we see in this country about this uneven balance between who produces and who pays the cost that we see all over the world. And then the third thing that I want to talk to you about or ask you to think about is the opportunity cost of racism and white supremacy. So racism takes energy and time and effort away from organizing for climate and other environmental justice and from creating innovative solutions. I was reminded recently of a quote from Toni Morrison from 1975, where she writes, "The very serious function of racism is distraction. It keeps you from doing your work. It keeps you explaining over and over again your reason for being." So studies tell us that Black people are significantly more concerned about climate change than white people and more willing to do something about it. And Latinx people are even more concerned and even more willing to do something about it. But the amount of effort that we expend addressing, experiencing racism means that we don't put that effort into the important work of climate justice.
Thank you so much, Reverend Johnson, for making those connections and starting out with the faith piece, because I think that you really put it in the most important connection of all, and that is the connection we all have to this beautiful and precious planet and all the life on it that we have. So thank you. Rob, would you like to comment also on this, these connections?
Sure. Thank you, Francesca, and thank you, Kimberly. I wouldn't say that social justice is the fundamental cause of the climate crisis. They're related. They're both outcomes, outcomes of a prevailing world economic system since the Industrial Revolution, which is also the start of the consequential human release of excess greenhouse gases into the biosphere. Now, that economic system, of course, the cause is capitalism, the primary way in which we've organized societies and countries in the world for those 250 years. We know capitalism is based on the private ownership of the means of production for profit. The mean entails extracting huge amounts of natural and human resources. We get the extreme outcomes of the climate crisis and social injustice when capitalism's closed system of ownership, production, and profit is allowed excessive determination over its amoral self. We get these dire outcomes when the concern for monetary value and materialism distort human worth and dignity. When human production, otherwise known as people, and the lives of their families and their communities aren't sufficiently nurtured by the governments whose role includes guardians of our well-being and stewardship. We get these outcomes when private ownership of land, mineral resources, air and water rights aren't sufficiently balanced by our common fate and mutual dependence on them. We get these outcomes when rules established by our consent are allowed to pillage the future for our current wants. We have collectively participated, allowed, and rewarded an amoral system to operate seemingly just this side of environmental havoc and degradation, social chaos, starvation, and dehumanized existence. We have supported institutions, businesses, and government leaders content to let our resources, our life, and our soul-sustaining systems get extracted, discarded in a linear system of production antithetical to the health of the natural world. We have the outcomes, the spoils of an economic system more akin to war. As disturbing and threatening as these outcomes of social injustice and climate change are, they can inspire our moral imagination to create a healthier, more dignified, and regenerative existence. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rob. And I'm glad you mentioned the C word, capitalism, because it is a kind of psychopathic system that is at the heart of the problems that we have here. And this kind of systemic looking at the situation that we face is what we really need to have to be able to go on and imagine another world that's possible.
This is Sustainable East End on WPKN Radio. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're listening to a panel discussion about the film 2040 and Project Drawdown on solutions to the climate crisis.
I'd like to turn to Tina. You have really worked, so you are working with the whole issue of women and drawdown. I wonder if you would like to bring that perspective into this issue of justice and climate.
So the question is about pulling more people into the donut. And women also suffer disproportionately the effects of climate change. So what we do, Drawdown 100 Women for Women, we gather in person, and I guess we might have to think about a Zoom meeting. The Hayground School adopted us, and we've been allowed their lovely space to gather. And I'm proud to say that we have a very diverse group where all voices are heard. And it's important that all voices come to the table, because I can't tell you what they want. They have to tell you what they want. I can't speak for anybody else. So it's important that we're all respected and that all our voices are heard. So furthermore, fossil fuels, keep them in the ground. We really need to switch over immediately to a regenerative energy society. We're doing good work out here on the East End. We got deep water wind coming in. We've got some solar things going on, but we need to do better and we need to do more. Wealth. Women will soon have over 30% of the wealth. We already make over 70% of the buying decisions for our households. So women, we are very powerful. American women, we are very powerful. We have a lot more power than we realize. So when we come together collectively, we can share that power. We can hold each other up. Because have you ever tried to hold your arms up like this? You can do it for some time, but what if you had two sisters on each side of you and they're holding their arms up like this, and we're all holding our arms up together? And that's what it really takes. So what we do in Drawdown 100 Women is called regenerative social culture. And just like regenerative agriculture refuels the soil and takes care of the earth, regenerative social culture refuels our communities. So I just want to give one quick anecdote from the pandemic. There's a sweet little neighborhood close to me. And, you know, we all go about our busy lives, but all of a sudden everything stops. There's no movies. There's no activities for the kids. There's no nothing. So the neighbors start sitting out in their front yards. And soon more neighbors start sitting out in their front yards. And then the neighbors are talking to each other and they're from their front yards. And now the neighbors are watching movies. There's drinking and popcorn and kids and old people, and everybody's having a great time. Nobody's spending any money. Nobody's burning any fossil fuels to go do these activities. So we've escaped from capitalism. So we need to talk about the gifting economy. We need to talk about local economies. We need to talk about becoming a transition town. We need to get the cars off our roads and take back our free spaces for ourselves. So maybe I've gone on too long and I may have strayed away from the question just a little bit, but that's what I have to say. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Tina. I can't help but mention the so important drawdown connection with women and justice, which is that, correct me if I have this wrong, but as I understand it, family planning and the education of girls put together are the two which create the most impactful impact on climate change, on being able to draw down our fossil fuel emissions.
Thank you so much, Francesca, for mentioning that, because that's actually something else that I wanted to mention, is that girls with goals make different choices. So we're also starting a mentorship program for young girls. And I say we're starting, but I'm hoping to get on board with a mentorship program that already exists. And I've been speaking with the Butterfly Effect Project, and I don't want to speak out of turn, but because they haven't agreed to work with us yet, but I'm hoping that we will be able to follow their model, because they are doing really great, awesome work with young girls. So when girls have goals, they choose to have children later, and they also choose to have less children. When a woman has children later and has less children, she can put more care into the children that she has. Just as Reverend Kim said that racism distracts us from the work we need to do, unwanted children and badly timed pregnancies can distract a woman from the work that she wants to do. And it is very important that a woman maintains the control of her body, and the timing and spacing of a woman's children are a woman's choice. We need to protect that choice for all women in our country, and extend that choice to women in other countries, although we, as Kim also pointed out, are the number one polluters. So we need to make sure that we are giving our girls a chance to get their own goals, so that we need every mind, every heart, every brain cell working on this climate problem. We need a lot more help.
So you mentioned education, and that's something that Miles is involved with and interested in doing. Miles, can you connect the dots here between climate and justice?
Thank you, Francesca. Right, so one of the ways that I was thinking about this connection was through a reflection on the film, on 2040. And so kind of the original idea, the premise of the film is that there already exist these solutions or technologies, or that the filmmaker Damon was looking for these pre-existing solutions to get us, to leverage to get us to a healthy climate. So the kind of immediate question from that assumption, and which the filmmaker addresses, which the film addresses, is if all these technologies are in existence, why is climate change still this existential problem, very far from solved? And a big part of the answer is the, yes, the C word, as you called it, Francesca, capitalism, you know, short-term financial interests, extractive practices. And it happens that these practices both degrade the environment and also perpetuate inequality. And that's racial inequality. That's also economic inequality, other social injustices. Right. So climate change, it's this threat to the planet. It's a threat to human survival and well-being. And many of the causes overlap, and the symptoms as well, with causes and symptoms of injustices. So for that reason, kind of our only choice, if we're looking to envision a better 2040, right, is to tackle this stuff together. So I think an important note, though, is that while there are injustices that are magnified by climate change and that are closely tied to environmental issues, that doesn't mean that right, that you can reduce all injustices to climate or to environmental issues. And I think something else to acknowledge there is that environmentalists kind of, or in the environmentalism as a movement, has not always, or has had a tradition of not siding with justice. It's had a racist history, a white supremacist history. You could consider preservation of natural lands in America that were coupled with Indian removal. And so not only have environmental issues, climate issues, and do these issues disproportionately affect people of color, Black people, Indigenous people, but also environmentalists have been complicit. Kind of to close that off, I'd say it's so key to look at the ways that climate issues and injustices are tied, are coupled, but also to address problems with the environment.
So Scott Carlin wanted to make a comment.
Thank you. I live in Hampton Bays. We have a lovely organization here. We've been slowed down a lot by COVID-19. It's Ecological Culture Initiative. And we're struggling to find powerful ways to engage in regenerative actions that can help heal all kinds of problems in our region. We've got problems with the local bays. We've got problems exacerbated by COVID-19 with food provisions for people, even greater economic inequality as a consequence of all of this. I also wanted to share a comment. There's a wonderful book came out a couple of years ago by a gentleman named Bruno Latour, rather well-known philosopher. It's called Down to Earth. Reverend Johnson started with some beautiful words about connecting to the interdependence of life. And she fell just one step short of actually mentioning the word Gaia. And I think there's something quite powerful, and Latour talks about this. There's something quite powerful in recognizing that Gaia is not just another scientific theory, but as Latour explains, a really paradigm-changing new way to think about who we are and what we're all about. And what really makes this effective is he wants to be both sympathetic to the cause of modernism and this goal of, you know, an easy, high quality of life that technology has given us. But he also wants to kind of bracket all of that and say that there's a lot of mythology, as a number of the speakers have spoken about, a lot of mythology around what's possible. And what's genuinely possible, what's physically possible, is to get about the business of healing the planet and move past the idea of economic fixation. So we've got a lot of work to do on economic inequality, but I think this book provides some really interesting ideas. So I'd like to share that.
This is Sustainable East End. You've been listening to a panel discussion on the film 2040. It's about Project Drawdown and the solutions to the climate crisis. Heard were panelists Reverend Kimberly Quinn Johnson of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the South Fork, Rob Calvert of Project Drawdown East End, Tina Mill, co-chair of Drawdown 100 Women for Women, and Miles Stokowski, a student at Middlebury College in Vermont. We also heard from Scott Carlin of the Ecological Culture Initiative in Hampton Bays. A free outdoor screening of the film 2040 The Regeneration is scheduled for Sunday, July 19th at 8:30 p.m. at the Southampton Arts Center, 25 Jobs Lane in Southampton Village. Details are at southamptonartscenter.org/events. More information about Project Drawdown and Drawdown East End is available at drawdown.org and drawdowneastend.org. Information about the Ecological Culture Initiative is at ecinY.org. Sustainable East End is heard on the third Wednesday of each month at this time, and also on the second Saturday of each month at 9 a.m. Programs are archived at www.sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and yours truly, Francesca Rhiannon.